We're studying of the captivity of the people of God as the Babylonians take them captive. Now let us remember that the Assyrians have taken the northern kingdom, and now the Babylonians have taken the Assyrians and conquered the southern kingdom. In the books of Daniel and Ezekiel, and quite a little bit in Jeremiah, is where we're going to be studying tonight. Fascinating study, I believe. We know that Judah has simply been devastated. I want to call your attention as we begin our study to the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter. Deuteronomy, the 6th chapter, for a beginning place. And I want to begin... That's not where I want to begin. It's the 7th chapter. That's a typo on the chart. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6. God said through Moses, "For thou art a holy people unto Jehovah thy God. Jehovah thy God hath chosen thee to be a people for his own possession above all peoples that are upon the earth, face of the earth. Jehovah did not set his love upon you, nor choose you because ye were more in number than any people, for ye were the fewest of all peoples. But because Jehovah loveth you, and because he would keep the oath which he sware unto your fathers, hath Jehovah brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Now we know that many, many years before, God had promised unto Abraham that I will make of you a great nation of people. When Moses first brought them up out of the land of Egypt, in Exodus chapter 19, in verses 5 and 6 specifically, we note that God himself called them a holy nation. Now, again, I would encourage you, if you're trying to remember the passages, these are two that you want to put up here and not forget. God promised Abraham, "I will make of you a great nation." And now we see, a few hundred years later, that God himself calls them a holy nation. And they were not a holy nation because they were great in number, as we saw in Deuteronomy 6. It was not because of some special attributes that they had. It was because God had made a promise unto Abraham, and he's fulfilling that promise. We note that God gave them the land, as he had promised unto Abraham, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. And we know that Joshua led them into that very land, the land which God had promised unto their fathers, as we see in Joshua chapter 21, beginning in verse 44. And you would like to think that everything would be good, but everything is far from good now. Hundreds of years down the pike, we see them in captivity, because when God brought them up out of the land of Egypt and promised to bless them, it was conditioned upon their keeping his covenant. And I want to call your attention to this text of Exodus chapter 19. We'll look at others as well. But in Exodus chapter 19, the people commit themselves to follow the commandments of God. In Exodus chapter 19, if you'll pick up the reading, beginning at verse, let's pick it up, if you would, please, at verse 7. Verse 7. It says, "And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and set before them all these words which Jehovah commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, 'All that Jehovah has spoken, we will do.' And Moses reported the words of the people unto Jehovah." Sounds like that as the covenant is being made with these people, that they're committed to follow it. They've made an agreement to keep the commandments of God and be faithful to him. And certainly that was the condition upon which they would be blessed. Now, the generation of Moses' day sounds like they're absolutely confident that they can keep the commandments and be faithful. Now, in Exodus chapter 24, if you'll turn the page and look over at verse 3. Exodus chapter 24, verse 3. Again it says, "And Moses came and told the people all the words of Jehovah. And all the ordinances and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Jehovah has spoken, we will do." Again, it sounds like they're quite confident, doesn't it? We're going to do what God said. In verse 7 of this same text, it says, "And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, all that Jehovah has spoken, we will do and be obedient." And it sounds like they're making a commitment to be faithful to God. They understand the requirements and the conditions, and they're going to keep them. But now we know what happened when Moses led them up out of Egyptian bondage. They began to murmur and complain. And there are just a few of the passages on the board that I'd like to make you aware of. In the book of Numbers, chapter 11, beginning in verse 1. Numbers chapter 11. Well, I'll get to it here in a minute. Chapter 11, verse 1. It says, "And the people were as murmurers, speaking evil in the ears of Jehovah. And when Jehovah heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of Jehovah burnt among them and devoured the uttermost part of the camp." God upset with them? Why is he upset with them? Well, they're complaining. And if you'll turn the page to the 14th chapter, we read of the spies having been sent into the land to spy it out. And you recall that 10 of the spies come back with an evil report and say, "We can't take the land that God promised to give unto Abraham." But Joshua and Caleb said, "Yes, we can." And in Numbers chapter 14, beginning in verse 1, what do they want to do to Joshua and Caleb? Stone them to death. Now, wait a minute. This really sounds like the people, does it not, that said, "What God commanded, we will do." Well, some things are changing. And if you look at the 16th chapter of the book of Numbers, in Numbers chapter 16, oh, by the way, in Numbers chapter 14, because of their lack of belief to go in and take the land, what did God tell them he was going to do to them? What would they have to do? Wander in the wilderness. At this point, for 38 more years, so 40 years total, they would have to wander in the wilderness because of their unbelief. Now turn to the 16th chapter. In the 16th chapter, you'll note beginning in verse 20, "Jehovah spake unto Moses and to Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell upon their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation?" And you'll note in verse 24, God said, "Speak unto the congregation, saying, get you up from about the tabernacle of Korah, Dothan, and Abiram." And what's God going to do to them? What does he do to them? 250 men that are following the teaching of Korah. What's he do to them?
Swallowed by the earth.
He just opens the earth up and they're gone. 250 people dead. Also in the 16th chapter. When the people saw these things, in verse 41, excuse me, it says, "But on the morrow all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, ye have killed the people of God." And what was God then determined to do? This is another passage you need to remember. Numbers chapter 16. Pardon me? Get back. What's going to happen to the people? I'm going to destroy them. And we notice that in the text, Moses tells Aaron, go and prepare a sacrifice. Excuse me. Go and prepare a sacrifice and get between the plague and the people. And Moses prepares the sacrifice, and stands between the plague and the people, and how many people have already died?
14,700.
Now, just a question for your consideration. When, in the age in which we live, when we hear of a battle or some tragedy that takes place, if 400 or 500 people are killed, do we get alarmed about that? Multiply that. 14,700. And that's right on the heels of some being destroyed because of their following Korah. 250. And that right on the heels of God sending fire and devouring some. And now after 14,700, if you'll turn to Numbers chapter 21, beginning in verse 4, it says, "And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way to the Red Sea, to compass the land of Edom. And the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spake against God, against Moses, wherefore have ye brought us up out of Egypt, to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, and there is no water, and our soul loatheth this light bread. And Jehovah sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people died." And here we're not told how many died, but it tells us much people died. That right on the heels of 14,700 people died because of the plague. Now, I want to ask you, you want to murmur? You want to complain against God? You know, things in life are not always pleasant. And sometimes we beat ourselves up, and sometimes we blame God. And you'll notice here in Numbers chapter 21 that the people are eating bread that God has provided. They're drinking water that God has brought forth from rocks. We know that during this 40-year period, they're wearing clothes that didn't wear out, shoes that didn't wear out. Their food, their clothing, everything they have is provided by God. And what do? Sit down and give thanks, right? No harm.
Just going back towards the beginning, here they went through the sea when it was departed. Saw miracles of God, door of cloud, door of fire, and looking light by night, shade by daytime. And then the high priest, Sarah, golden calves.
Yes.
Knowing and they've seen all these Egyptians killed the firstborn. And not only that, but the ones that drowned in the sea, knowing the power of God.
Yes.
Then in Leviticus 10, verse 2, Nadab and Abihu. And they knew because they were the sons of Aaron.
That's right.
And they had been there when the commandments were read.
Yeah.
And they saw all the same things.
Well, that's right. And I think the thing that is shocking to us is how soon these departures took place. When they came up out of the land of Egypt, when they first began to murmur and then began to ask Aaron to build them an idol that they can worship, how long have they been out of Egypt? Anyone remember? Very short time, yes. In the neighborhood of 3 months out from Egypt. And now they're complaining and fussing and now wanting an idol. Forgotten all about the great things that God has done. And we want to see that Moses had told them time and time, and these are passages that are in your memory. We've asked you to try to commit these to memory. Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 8. And then the chapters Deuteronomy 28 through 30, where Moses told them precisely what God would do if they worshiped idols.
Did Pharaoh increase their workload?
Yes, he did.
And then now you have to make bricks without straw?
That's correct. Yes.
You would remember something like that.
Well, you would like to think. Yes, you'd like to think. Now, as Deuteronomy sets forth, and we've looked at some of these passages, I don't know if I want to take the time tonight to look at all of the chapter 28, but I would encourage you to write that down and just read the chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 28. I want to highlight some of this. You remember, and if you'll look at your Bible, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning in verse 1, down through verse 6, Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 6, God told them that I will bless you in everything you put your hand unto. If you do what? Obey me. Keep my commandments. But then beginning at verse 15, you see the absolute flip side. I'll curse you in everything. And he names them off just like he did in the first few verses. I'll curse you in everything you put your hand into if you disobey me. If you worship and serve idols, if you don't keep my commandments. Now, having said that, drop down, if you will, to verse 20. We see some specifics. It says, Jehovah will send upon thee cursing, discomfiture, and rebuke in all that thou puttest thy hand unto until thou be destroyed and until thou perish quickly because of the evil of thy doings, whereby thou hast forsaken me. And just continue on through the chapter. You see some specifics would be pronounced upon them. In verse 36, it says, Jehovah will bring thee and thy king, whom thou shalt set over thee, unto a nation that thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers. And there shalt thou serve other gods, wood and stone. And you see some of the consequences of that. Question, did they have a king at this point? No, they didn't have a king. Moses telling them what's going to happen when you worship and serve idols. The day will come when you'll ask for a king. And when you have a king and you worship and serve other gods, here's what's going to happen to you. In verse 58 of this same chapter, it says, if thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that thou mayest fear this glorious and fearful name, Jehovah thy God, then Jehovah will make thy plagues wonderful, and the plagues of thy seed, even great plagues and of long continuance, and sore sicknesses and of long continuance. Do you see what he's telling them? Again, read the chapter. Chapter 28 is just filled with curses that would be upon them if they disobeyed God.
Seems that a weak faith and short memory go hand in hand.
They do indeed. Yes, they do indeed. And so this becomes quite a fascinating chapter to us. I don't know why that's not going. There we go. How far did I go? Okay. Push it a dozen times, I'll be several slides ahead. All right. Choices. They had choices to make, and we do too. We've seen this word, if. If you keep my commandments. If you don't keep my commandments. I'm not sure that I can over-exaggerate that. When we study this portion of Old Testament history, we see them messing up time after time after time after time, not having regard and respect for the name of God. Yet, as we read these things, what does that do to our faith? Now, those of you who are here tonight, you're here because you read these things and your faith is up here. But you know, not everybody believes these things like that. Sometimes we read these things and we have the attitude that they did during the days of captivity or just prior to captivity. God won't do anything. I know He said it, but it don't mean anything. You see, the years have a way of passing. And when the years pass, Carolyn, what happens to our memory? We think everything's just always the way it is, and that's not true. In fact, as Paul writes to those in Thessalonica regarding judgment that God would pronounce upon them, eternal condemnation, it was upon those who do not know God, those who do not obey the gospel. Now we read that, and that's just as plain as language can make it. I give you And to give you who are troubled rest with us when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and on those who do not obey the gospel. Isn't that simple? What does it take to complete our understanding that if we are not obedient to the Lord, we'll be lost? Now, we look at these numerous illustrations in the Old Testament, and we seem very clear on that. And we see that Joshua told them precisely what was going to happen to them if they did not keep his commandments. And he told them that God has brought you into the land. Not one thing has failed, but just as sure as he has brought you into the land, he will take it away if you do not keep his commandments. And then we're well familiar with the statement that Joshua made, the challenge unto the people of Israel in the 24th chapter when he said, "Choose you this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods of the Amorites or the gods of your fathers that were beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah." And we're well familiar with that passage, right? "Choose you this day whom ye will serve." How did the people respond? All right, we'll be faithful to God. Now, why? Why will we be faithful to God? Look at verse 16. "The people answered and said, 'Far be it from us that we should forsake Jehovah to serve other gods. For Jehovah our God, He it is that brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, and that did those great signs in our sight, and preserved us in all the way wherein we went, and among all the peoples through the midst of whom we passed. And Jehovah drove out from before us all the peoples, even the Amorites that dwelt in the land. Therefore, we also will serve Jehovah, for He is our God.'" Why are these people committed to serving God? What do they remember? The miracles that God did. Now let's keep in mind here that Joshua brings into the promised land a different generation from those who wandered in the wilderness. What happened to those who wandered in the wilderness? They died. And of course we know that from 20 years old and older, they died. But we have a bunch of young people that you add 40 years to their life, and what do you have? You have a minimum age of people who are, you have a maximum age of people who are about 60 years old. And then their children that are brought into the land. But these that are 60 years old, they've seen these things. They came across the Red Sea. They wore the clothes that didn't wear out. They drank of the water that came from a rock. And they ate the manna that fell from heaven. And now they come into the land and they affirm their faithfulness to God because we know who God is and we know what God has done. Now, when we come to their children, what had their children seen? These folks had seen the crossing of the Red Sea. They'd come across that. They'd seen the plagues. But what had their children seen? Those that were born in the wilderness now, that did not see the plagues, did not cross the Red Sea. Yes, they'd seen that. What else?
The crossing of the Jordan,
yes, that was what I was looking for. Their children have crossed the Jordan River, just like their fathers had crossed the Red Sea. Now, you would again like to think that crossing the Jordan River during the time of its flood stage, that would be a great big thing in your memory. And so when you would come into the promised land, you would be faithful. But this brings us then to the period of the judges and what happened. After Joshua and his generation died, what happened to the people? Forgot all about God. Forgot all about Him. Now here are folks who crossed the Jordan River on dry ground and forgot all about God. And what we find is then for a cycle of about 15 times during about the next 300 years, they worship idols, they worship God. They worship idols, they worship God. And back and forth they go. So when we look at this period of captivity, you would like to think that you could look back in history and learn the lessons And then even previous to the period of captivity, you've got prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet coming to them, telling them not only about their history, but reminding them of what you promised you would do and what God said He would do. And it's coming. And they call upon them to repent. Wouldn't you think that you would listen? Well, we'd like to think that we would listen, wouldn't we? But did they listen? No, they didn't listen. Turn, if you will, to the prophecy of Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 9. Now, we're jumping fast forward here several hundred years in the history of Israel. In the prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 9. Pick up the reading. Randy, if you would please, for me at verse 8. Chapter 9, verse 8. And read through verse 12, please.
Isaiah 9, 8 through 12. The Lord sends a message against Jacob, and it falls on Israel. The people know it. That is, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria. Asserting in pride and in arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will replace them with cedars. Therefore the Lord raises against them adversaries from Rezin and spurs their enemies on. The Arameans on the east and the Philistines on the west. And they devour Israel with gaping jaws. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out.
All right, two things. One is their arrogance. We won't take the time tonight to cite the numerous passages that tell us about God's attitude toward arrogance. But we know that arrogance or pride goes before the fall, as we quote that. And we know that the wisdom writer said, pride or arrogancy do I hate. We know what God's attitude toward that is, but yet we see these people, and we talked about this, I believe, last Sunday morning, where these people said to God, you can tear it down, we'll build it back. You can tear it down, we'll make it better. And you talk about arrogance. Look at their history. Look at the cause of the things that they suffered. And then to have this kind of attitude. Two things I want you to see in verse 12. We know that their enemies would devour them with an open mouth. How does yours read there, Randy, verse 12?
Devour Israel with gaping jaws.
Gaping jaws. We see the idea of that just to be consumed.
It says literally, the marginal reference, literally the whole mouth.
Yeah, just to be consumed. And yet it tells us that the anger of God turns not away, but His hand is stretched out still. And I've heard that last expression explained a couple of ways, and then I'll tell you my understanding of it. Some have suggested that this punishment upon His people was something that was bound to happen because He had said that it was. Well, there's no doubt that's true. Another thing that has been thought of on this passage is His hand is stretched out still. You see that occur three times in the next few verses. His hand is stretched out still. There are those who take the position, in fact, I'm one of them, that this implies the mercy of God. He's angry with them. His judgment is going to come down like a hammer on them. But His hand is stretched out still. When you stand before someone with an outstretched hand, what does that imply you're willing to do? You're willing to receive them back, to forgive them. But if they will not, then what's coming? God's wrath is going to come upon them. Now, they wouldn't listen. Amos adds the words, and we looked at this Sunday, so we won't reiterate this, but I will call your attention to it. In Amos chapter 4, beginning in verse 6, Amos said to them that I'm going to cause cleanness of teeth among you. I like that particular wording. Cleanness of teeth. What's he saying to them? During this time, just prior to their destruction and captivity. You're not going to have anything to eat. You see, if your teeth are clean, it's because there isn't anything to get them dirty. You're not going to have any food to eat. And I'm going to make it rain on one city and another city, there's not going to be any rain. so that those in the city where it's dry will travel over to the city where there's water, and what's going to happen to them all there? Well, let's just put it this way. Let's suppose during Southern California's drought, I've got a 5-gallon bucket full of water and you all don't have any. So you come to my house. What's going to happen to my 5-gallon bucket full of water? Well, it's all going to be gone. Now, if one city has water and this city does not, and they travel over to that one, Amos said that that city then won't have any water either. And I'm going to send disease among you. I'm going to send disease among your crops, your fruit trees, your vineyards, everything. It's all going to die. And furthermore, Amos said, I'm going to raise up soldiers against you, and they're going to kill you. To the extent that the stink of your camp will come up to your nose. Now Amos tells them all these things, and after each one, he said, yet you've not returned to me. Yet you've not returned to me. And then he tells them in verse 12, prepare to meet thy God. Now I tell you what, folks, when we look at these warnings and we see the chastisements upon God's people, we need to be impressed with that. There's some powerful and vivid lessons here in Old Testament history. And they wouldn't listen. When we read of God's will for us today, what He wants us to do, and we're not doing it. And we know we're not doing it. How do we excuse ourselves from the coming judgment that God has said will most certainly come? And we shake our head in amazement. Lack of understanding. And yet that's the attitude that most people here in Lancaster have. And we have to be careful that most of those who claim to be members of the body of Christ don't develop that attitude. I know God said that, but surely it won't happen to me. It won't happen to me. The passing of time, we become comfortable, complacent. And think that God's judgment is so far away that it won't ever happen. And Amos said, you get ready. God's judgment is coming. Prepare to meet thy God. And then he tells them who God is. Now, Assyria, we've looked at this passage already. In Isaiah chapter 10, beginning in verse 5, is referred to as the instrument of God's wrath, the rod of God's wrath upon Israel. But yet we know that Judah was to be destroyed by the Babylonians. And I don't know that we've looked at all of these passages, but we know that Jeremiah was a prophet during this time prior to the captivity by the Babylonians. And in Jeremiah chapter 25, look if you will, beginning at verse 8. Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 8. It says, therefore thus saith Jehovah of hosts, because ye have not heard my words. Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Jehovah, and I will send unto Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land, and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and I will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and a hissing, and perpetual desolations. Now those who were the enemies of God's people, when they saw the Babylonians come upon them, what would they do to God's people? They'd just laugh at them. Make fun of them. Well, why? God's people had every opportunity on earth to be blessed. And they're just not interested. They won't listen. And so the coming doom is soon to come upon them. And Jeremiah tells them who's going to do it. And how long it will last. How long would this captivity last? 70 years. That's right. Babylon would take them into captivity for 70 long years. In chapter 27 of Jeremiah, beginning in verse 8, it says, and it shall come to pass when the nation that the kingdom which will not serve the name or the same Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and that will not put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation will I punish, saith Jehovah, with the sword and with the famine and with the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand. Now, Even Judah, when they are worshiping idols, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, comes upon them to conquer them, if they will repent, and if they will submit unto King Nebuchadnezzar, they will be allowed to stay in the land. Do you see that? That's what Jeremiah is telling them to do. Don't resist. Don't go down to Egypt and try to make an alliance with them. But you agree with King Nebuchadnezzar to be his servants, and you'll live. But what if you don't? Then you're going to be taken captive. Now that's just the way it is. In Jeremiah chapter 39, we know, as I was dating myself Sunday, as Paul Harvey says, most of you in this audience know who that is. We see the rest of the story. In Jeremiah 39, beginning in verse 6, it says, "Then the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah and Riblah before his eyes. Also the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. The Chaldeans burned the king's house, the houses of the people with fire, and break down the walls of Jerusalem." What happened to the people of Jerusalem? Well, they're taken captive. And now you see, Judah doesn't exist on this map. The Babylonian Empire has taken over all of it. During this time of Babylonian captivity, Daniel was among the first group that was taken captive. Now, one of the things that we have tried to suggest in previous studies is that the captivity of the southern kingdom came in waves. Nebuchadnezzar didn't just go in and demolish them and it's all over. It came in waves. And during the time of the first wave, young Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as we know their names, were taken captives during that time. And as you open your Bible to the book of Daniel, Daniel is writing a very fascinating book. We've studied Daniel, and it hasn't been all that long ago. What, maybe 6 months? Maybe it was eight.
Sure.
Was it 6 years? Maybe closer. But as we studied Daniel, we noted who he was and what he did, what job he had, and we noted the bulk of the things that he had to prophesy about. And as we look at Daniel chapter 1, we see the time frame. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. Here's the first wave. The date was about 606 B.C. Now the significance of that is the dating of the release of the people of God to go home. We've got a date on that. When was that? All right, 536. Now, as you run that thing forward, see, you just subtract 70 years from this date, and you arrive at that date. And history bears that out. That's when they were able to return to their homeland. Now, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we know, were given positions of honor by King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel, as we noted at the conclusion, I believe, of our study last time, in Daniel chapter 2, records that Daniel requested, verse 49, Daniel 2, 49, that Daniel requested of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel was in the gate of the king. Now that tells us that all of these young captives had very prestigious places given to them by King Nebuchadnezzar. But even so, King Nebuchadnezzar had some things he had to learn. Now evidence shows us that the Jews were allowed to establish prosperous and comfortable colonies along an irrigation canal called the River Chebar. Now you'll notice in Daniel chapter 1 that it is here that Daniel sees a vision. And the vision that he sees, he gets to see what some have described as the throne room of God. And from that perspective, he gets to see the people of Israel, the real condition that they're in. And he writes somewhat about that throughout the book of Daniel. But the theme of the book of Daniel is somewhat futuristic. He's pointing to things that are yet to come. And as he points to things that are yet to come, we note in Daniel chapter 2 that King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Joey, you want to tell me about his dream? Daniel chapter 2. King Nebuchadnezzar saw this image. And what was it like?
The bronze and the stone and the four different elements that comprise the being, and each one of them represented a kingdom in the future. And then he said that in the days of the of Roman kings, that God would establish a kingdom that would last forever and would crush all the others.
All right, this is a very, very important prophecy. So if you're writing things down, you write down Daniel chapter 2. And you'll note that in verse 25 of Daniel chapter 2, Daniel comes before the king. He's brought before the king by a man named Arioch. And Daniel begins to tell King Nebuchadnezzar the significance of what he has seen in this dream, because all the magicians and enchanters and so forth, that the Chaldeans can't tell him what his dream was, and they can't tell him what it meant. But Daniel is brought, and Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that there is a God in heaven who has revealed to you what shall be in the latter days. When are the latter days? Keeping in mind that Daniel is writing somewhere in the neighborhood of 650 or so B.C., he's pointing to a time of about 33 A.D., hundreds of years down the channel of time in the future. And when he tells Nebuchadnezzar the significance of this dream, this is what God has said will occur in the last days, the latter times. Now, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar, here's what you saw. You saw a great image, and that image had a head of gold. It had a chest and arms of silver. It had a belly and thighs of brass and feet and legs of iron and clay. Now, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar, you saw that image. To God took a stone out of the mountain and smote that image on its feet, and the whole image crumbled. Now, that's what you saw. Now, would that be frightening to you? Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, here's what that means. Nebuchadnezzar, thou art the head of gold. Now you just put a benchmark right there. Starting with the Babylonian Empire. Thou art the head of gold. Who made you king, Nebuchadnezzar? God did. Read it, if you will, please, in verse 37. Thou, O king, art king of kings, unto whom the God of heaven hath given the kingdom, the power, and the strength, and the glory. Who made him king? God did. Why did God make him king? Punish his people. That's right. In verse 38 it says, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, hath he given into thy hand, and hath made thee to rule over them all. Thou art the head of gold. And after thee shall rise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that crusheth all these shall it break in pieces and crush. Now let's pause there. Daniel is telling King Nebuchadnezzar, there's going to be a sequence of kingdoms, beginning with you. But your kingdom is not going to last, Mr. Nebuchadnezzar. How do we know that? Because there's going to be another one. And that second one's not going to last. How do we know that? Because there's going to be another one, a third one. And that kingdom is not going to last. How do we know that? Well, there's going to be a fourth one. But it all starts with you, Nebuchadnezzar. And these kingdoms are not going to last. Now what we can do is to combine Bible history with secular history, and we can put a name on every one of these. Daniel puts a name on this one. This is the Babylonian Empire. Ezra puts a name on the next one. Who was that? The Medo-Persian Empire. That's right. Now, in the intertestamental period, there is another kingdom. Now, how long was it between the testaments, the old and the new? About 400 years. Now, Daniel, in the book of Daniel, tells us about some of the things that would take place in that intertestamental period. But he doesn't elaborate on some of the details that you and I know from secular history. Who would be a prominent figure during this 400 years? Pardon me?
The Greeks.
That's right. Alexander the Great, you recall, who is described as one who sat down and cried because he conquered everything there was to conquer and there wasn't anybody else to fight. Now, some say that's so. Some say that's not so. Some say it wasn't Alexander that cried. It was the soldiers that sat down and cried because they had been fighting for so long. They wanted to go home. Now, you can see why when you look at a map and you consider where Greece is and how far away they were when they finally wound things up and went home. They were over here in the Arabian Desert. A long, long way from home. A lot of time has transpired. And so Alexander the Great ruled over the world, as it were. And then as we come into New Testament times, who is it that rules this fourth kingdom? The Romans rule. Yes. Now, interestingly enough, we know that Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar some things about this fourth kingdom. Look, if you will, at verse 41. Verse 41. Now, remember that it was made of iron and clay, this fourth kingdom, verse 40. But verse 41 says, "And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom." What's going to be a characteristic of this fourth kingdom? Be divided. Now, if you look at the next portion of the verse, "But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay, and as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken." Again, what's the nature of this fourth kingdom? It's going to be divided. It's going to have within it some strength, and it's also going to have a great deal of weakness. Now, we know some things about the Roman kingdom. Eventually, the Roman Empire was not ruled over by Caesars. What happened to it? Who began to rule over it? Remember that Caesar had four generals, and they began to fuss and fight over the territory, and the territory began to divide among these four generals. What's happening to the Roman Empire? It's beginning to collapse. Well, now that is true, but I believe that same is true about the Roman kingdom. It began to collapse.
Around what year are we talking?
That it collapsed?
Yeah.
400.
I mean, yeah, about 400. Yeah.
I thought they had Caesars up until then.
Well, maybe I need to rethink that. I'll consider that. But I was thinking that, well, in fact, I'm sure, Randy, it might not be just four generals, but a number of the generals divided the kingdom of Rome. That's what Daniel is telling us. It would not be a strong kingdom. It would be divided.
You were eventually overrun by Germanic tribes.
That's right. That's right. Now, in the days of these kings, the fourth kings, what's God going to do? You remember that stone? It's going to hit this image in the feet. It's going to destroy the whole thing. Destroy the whole thing.
Set up his kingdom.
Set up his kingdom. Yeah. And it won't ever be destroyed. All right, we're going to talk some more about that next time.